This is Legal Luminaries. Join us as we delve into the inspiring stories of some of the greatest legal minds to have shaped South Africa's democracy and law. I'm Imandra Petty, your guide through the series.
It's my pleasure to welcome Judge Kate O'Regan, who sat on the Constitutional Court bench between the years of 1994 and 2009. We'll cover some of her background and her history and some of the catalytic events in her life that led her to a life in court. And Judge O'Regan, it's such a pleasure to have you with me. I know you said I can use Kate, so we're going to just be Kate and Iman for the rest of our interview. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, man. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's kick off here. You were born in Liverpool, in England. You moved to South Africa with your family when you were still quite young. And you grew up in apartheid-era South Africa, and this is where you witnessed a lot of the social injustices in your environment at the time. What do you remember seeing, and what impact did that have on you and your views on equality and justice?
I suppose, like every child, it sort of takes a while for you to realize the environment in which you're living. Although my parents had moved to South Africa when I was 7, they were always dismayed by the situation of apartheid. So at home, you know, that was part of the conversation, part of the sense of injustice and unfairness, but also a sense that, you know, one should do what you could to try to contribute to a fairer society. So that came from home. I went to a Catholic convent in Cape Town. And again, although it was, while I was there, only for white girls, it was one of the convents that opened up quite early on in the 1980s to admit students of color. And I would say that quite a lot of the teachers we had were also not pro-apartheid. So I sort of did grow up in that kind of, I suppose, what might be described as a sort of white liberal environment in Cape Town. And I then went to university, initially to study journalism, actually, and went to work as a cub reporter in my first university holidays, which were the end of 1976, and I was working for the Cape Argus. And of course, at the time, the country was in turmoil following the uprising in Soweto in June 1976. You know, things didn't settle down politically. And I remember going with some of the reporters to cover events, protests, particularly in Langa and Gugulethu during that time working for Cape Argus. But one of the things was suggested to me then was that maybe it would be useful to do a law degree if I wanted to be a journalist, because there wasn't a journalism degree at the University of Cape Town. And people said, well, do a law degree. And so off I went to do a law degree. And, sort of got completely absorbed in law. So I was really a law student during some, you know, times of enormous change in South Africa, times of the re-emergence of political activism in a very visible and audible way in our society, which had been so heavily repressed, sort of between the banning of the liberation movements, the Rivonia trial from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s. So, you know, being a student during the time of the murder of Steve Biko, for example, the banning of the Black Consciousness movements in October 1977, following the death of Steve Biko, you know, these were times when you couldn't be a student and not alert to politics and what was happening in the broader country.
I mean, I really didn't anticipate that, Kate, from journalism to the judiciary. What a fascinating pivot that you made. It was born out of necessity. As you say, there wasn't a journalism course that was available at the time, but it was your entry point into this world of how you could formalize what you do in terms of justice and human rights. So talking about UCT, you were educated there, but you were also educated at the University of London and different places in between, with a special focus on labor law and land rights. We now know what the catalytic factor would have been in terms of what you would have seen, the ethos and the context of South Africa at that time. Tell us a little bit more about why this keen focus on human rights, labor and land issues.
Well, of course, those were the things that were the struggle against apartheid. These were two very important areas. So what happened is I was finishing my law degree in 1980. Shortly after that, the government introduced the amendments to the Labor Relations Act, which permitted black workers lawfully to join trade unions. And there had been an enormous ferment around unionization in South Africa since the Durban strikes of 1973. And this led to extraordinarily rapid establishment of the black trade union movement in South Africa. And so when I went into legal practice at the beginning of 1982, it seemed like a really interesting area in which to work. And I was fortunate to be working in a law firm where there was an experienced labor lawyer who was looking for somebody who would do all the gopher work, running around, delivering papers, taking statements and all of that. So that was a great, you know, opportunity and a great introduction to working with organized labor and thinking about the use of law in relation to promoting trade unionism and the rights of workers. And, you know, similarly, in the same sort of community and time, I became involved in working with organizations that were seeking to defend communities from being forcibly removed under apartheid's land laws. And so again, in many ways, I came to these from practice, from thinking about how you could use law, even in the difficult days of apartheid, to protect people's rights and to ensure that people weren't subjected to injustice.
Because following all of that, and you have now reflected on, in part, on your time working with trade unions, with communities, especially those facing evictions under apartheid land policies, you've also edited a book on forced removals, another digest of labor arbitration decisions, and a range of published articles. Why was it important for UK to focus on this area of South African justice?
Well, you know, I think one of the reasons why I went into law in the first place was for the realization that law, although it is not a complete control on power, it is a very important part of the way in which a political system works. One of the unusual things about apartheid was that there were spaces in the law where you could assert rights, even in the worst times. So during the 10 years, in a sense, from 1980 to 1990, there were some really distinct gains in the courts. So first, the Legal Resources Center's successful litigation against what were known as the pass laws, the laws in terms of which black Africans had to carry with them at all times a kind of identity document or a pass, the dom pass, as it was called, failing which they would be arrested. And those documents identified everybody's right to live or not in the cities. And the core part of influx control, of exclusion from the cities under apartheid, was that most black South Africans were not permitted to live and work in the cities. And of course, that's where most of the working opportunities were. So the pass laws effectively kept people away from work, black South Africans away from working in the cities. And that's why people broke them to come into the cities to try and find work and then were arrested in large numbers. And that legislation was embedded in the apartheid system from the 1950s. And the Legal Resources Center successfully brought two challenges against that in the 1980s, which were part of the reasons for the collapse of the influx control system by the late 1980s.
What that tells me, Kate, is that you had to be shrewd and inventive when it came to the application of the law and looking for spaces where you could use the existing framework for change. And I think it's a great sermon analogous to what's happening in South Africa today, where there might be pieces of the legislation, even though, you know, we're lauded for having the best constitution in the world, frustrations with certain issues in law for legal practitioners, for those in the judiciary, to think differently and in a more lateral way about how we can be inventive and innovative around the law. And I think it's a good place for you to make some commentary on that, especially for new legal minds entering the profession.
Yes, I think that's right. And there are sort of two ways of thinking about this. So one is, what are the opportunities within the legal system to try and use the law to promote a more just society? That's one area. The other area, and one of the things that I think is particularly challenging in South Africa, is that very often our laws and often our policies are quite good policies. It's not uniformly the case, but quite often they are. But they don't actually live in people's lives. So they're there in the statute book, or in theory, people have got rights or the law should be working well. But for a range of complex reasons, which are not related to how the law itself is written, those don't actually have life in people's live in people's lives. And I think for lawyers and for citizens and activists, this second problem is about how to make sure that what we do have is in fact reflected in the way in which our society is structured. And so, you know, these are not small problems, they're big problems, and changing the patterns of inequality and injustice, which still are so embedded in South African society, even 30 years later, is an ongoing project and, you know, a challenging one, which does, as you say, require perseverance, imagination, and commitment.
I really love that line, the law should live in people's lives. It should have expression in their everyday. And we'll come back to that if we can. But you touch on something really important. And it's very striking in this interview and conversation with you that the issue of land in all its manifestations has had such a profound impact and influence on people's lives. How do you evaluate the debate around access to land and land restitution in South Africa now? And by several accounts, you know, prolific writers like Advocate Thembeka and Lucas Torbi, even as recently as October 2024, says it doesn't seem as if government has done a credible job in speeding things up. There's been a great deal of inertia around this issue.
It's absolutely right. So the way in which the legal system currently addresses this problem is to separate out land claims, which were by and large aimed to restore land to people who had it taken away from them under racist legislation, and land reform, which is about to recognize that historically, as a result of, you know, historic laws and practices and the process of colonial dispossession and apartheid, a significant portion of arable land in South Africa is earned and worked on by white farmers. So there was this kind of split between land reform and land claims. And we've had a lot of land claims, and many of them have been successful, but it hasn't really changed in the kind of way one would have hoped, patterns of land use and land holding. And the same in relation to land reform. There were some very interesting proposals in the National Planning Commission's report of 2012, which was looking forward to how South Africa could move forward over the next two decades, which, you know, I think have wonderful to read. And you think, gosh, these are really good ideas, but have never really actually been implemented in any way, as so much of that report. Very sadly, we sort of saw a period of not engaging with some of the most important issues in our society. So there's no doubt that this does, you know, this is right at the forefront of things that need to be addressed. On the other hand, I think one needs also to be realistic that land reform is hard. It's hard everywhere. It's being tried in and instituted in many societies. And the fact that we're struggling with it is not something that means that, you know, we're especially bad people, especially not able to do things. Many societies struggle with land reform and trying to produce more equitable patterns of land holding. And there are also deep disagreements about how to go about doing that. So one of the big disagreements amongst scholars and activists and policymakers in South Africa is, you know, should we be looking at forms of communal land tenure, or should we be looking at individual land tenure? In other words, should, when we do land reform, should individuals get to own their own pieces of land, or should we see it as a kind of form of communal tenure? And there are obviously long historical roots in both forms of tenure, both communal and individual tenure, and there are debates to be had about this. There are also long debates to be had about how gender and women's rights should work into this, because as my colleague and friend Albie Sachs often says, one of the things that unites South Africans is deep patterns of patriarchy. And that's very true. And so, you know, when we think about how to address land, we need to recognize that it's a very difficult problem upon which we will inevitably disagree. But the only way to go forward is to have those disagreements, to talk about them, to shake the ideas around until we find a way forward that will work.
It's so interesting. When we think about unity, we think about it only in positive terms. But, you know, it does have an insidious side when people are united around something that, you know, that isn't very good, and something that can be quite tragic and violent, especially in the South African context. I want to come to the 1994 moment, Kate, when you were appointed as a judge to what was then a brand new Concord. And you have actually, during your time on the bench, also acted as Deputy Chief Justice. I mean, how do you remember it? We'll go in a moment to some of the judgments. And it was so hard for me to pick out certain judgments that you had a voice on. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But just overall, what was your feeling? If you had to personify it in a way, I mean, how would you do that?
I have to say that I didn't think it likely that I would ever be appointed to the court. I was persuaded to put my name in the hat because, having been somebody who'd also worked on gender equality issues, I had said in various places that I thought it was important that there would be, you know, the bench would be more diverse, that there should be people of color and there should be women on the bench. Bench is what we describe as the place where judges sit. And in South Africa in 1994, you know, of the 150 high court judges and above, only three or four, a handful, were not white men. So, you know, that sort of came back to haunt me when people said, well, if we're going to need to have women, we're going to have women who put their names in the hat. And my original response was, don't be so ridiculous. I'm far too young to do that. And, you know, I'm an academic at the University of Cape Town with small children. No, this doesn't make sense. But anyway, you know, I think I was persuaded that it was a good idea to have names in the hat, and I didn't ever really think that I would be appointed. When I learned that I was going to be appointed, it was, I suppose the one word is, a mixture of being overwhelmed and rather horrified, because it just hadn't seemed very likely. And, you know, it did involve an enormous shakeup in our lives. So we had small children. My husband had to move his legal practice, and we all had to move to Johannesburg, and it was quite a big thing. But, you know, it does show you that you should never apply for a job that you don't want to get, because you never know whether you will get it.
I think that's such a delicious anecdote. And I think you were 37, right, when that happened. And your husband, you know, was also an advocate. As you say, things had to move. And maybe just a commentary on that, Kate, especially since we talked about patriarchy just a second or two ago, around the importance of having that support system in family, but particularly having the support of a husband who sometimes, because, you know, it's an inversion almost to what typically happens in society, where a woman is normally making a lot of sacrifices for her male counterpart or has the other part. But in your case, your husband did for you.
I'm so pleased you asked that, Iman, because it's so true. I mean, I really, really think I have been unbelievably fortunate and blessed, you know, to have a husband who's always believed that, you know, I am an equal, and he does support and enable me to do things. And, you know, I don't think that's that common out there. And, you know, it wasn't easy. You know, we both had to move, we had to juggle and find ways to manage this. But it really is important, I think, to recognize that our conceptions of being a man often don't include within it the idea that actually you should be part of enabling your partner to flourish. And I think that's a very common conception of what it means to be a woman, but it's not always what the conception of being a man is. And so I was really fortunate to have such a loving, supportive husband through this.
Well, you definitely got a good one there, and you can take that home from me. Was there gender pay parity on the bench?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, very important principle. And I do remember when we sat around talking about the terms and conditions of employment of judges, you know, so they sort of set out in these regulations. And there was, because the Constitutional Court was a new court, that, you know, it had to be included within these. And I remember Albie Sachs saying, but there's no provision for maternity benefits. And Yvonne and I looked at each other and said, no, Albie, this is not what's going to happen in the next little while. And of course, ironically, of course, it was Albie who had a small child while we were on the court, and, you know, 10 or 12 years later. So it wasn't only something that applied to the female members of the court. But, you know, I do think, you know, that we were fortunate that we had pay equality and also an open conversation about what the terms and conditions for judges should be.
Your thoughts on Justice Mandisa Meyer becoming the first Chief Justice on the bench?
I think it's always wonderful, isn't it, when we feel that what had seemed to be no-go areas for women become a place for a woman. And, of course, Chief Justice Meyer has done this throughout her career. She's led first at the Supreme Court of Appeal and now the Constitutional Court. And I really wish her well, and know that, you know, what is very important is that she has a supportive community around her to make it possible for her to do what is a really difficult and challenging job.
Kate, I was hard-pressed to pick just one significant judgment you authored, because they range between ones dealing with affirmative action, and we think of the Minister of Finance versus Van Heerden in 2004, Duste versus Jordan, that was 2002, and the constitutionality of criminalizing sex work. In that particular one, you were a dissenting voice. You argued that criminalizing sex work violated the right to equality and disproportionately affected women who, as it happens, are most commonly prosecuted for sex work. And you also emphasized the importance of autonomy and choice, arguing that the law unfairly discriminated based on gender. Which cases stand out for you in that court and pieces of work that you are personally most proud of?
You know, people quite often ask that question, and I always find it difficult to say. Being on the first bench, every case was a sort of an adventure in a kind of way. It was thinking about the law differently. And some of them one remembers because of the importance of the implications and impact of the judgment. Some of them one remembers because of the complicated law that was there, or the attempt to try to imagine the law in a way that would promote justice. So there aren't really individual cases that I would say I was most proud of. There were just so many important cases. I think one of the most distinctive ones that we heard was the certification of the 1996 Constitution, which required the court to decide if the Constitution complied with the constitutional principles that had been set in the multi-party negotiating process at Kempton Park. And so that involved us having to look right across the Constitution. It was a huge case. You know, we heard argument for 2 weeks. And what was important about the case, I think, was that it meant the court really had to understand the whole Constitution right from the start. And I think, and it very often makes some decisions on aspects of, you know, I think there were about 200 different issues arose in the case. That was a really interesting exercise. The number of different people who argued before the court, there were probably at least 50 different groups of people who came before the court to argue it. So it was a really unusual case, and one where I think we all deepened our understanding of the text of the Constitution. And then there were, you know, there are cases that affect ordinary people very much. So the HIV case around nevirapine, and which was the question of whether the government limiting access to nevirapine, which is the antiretroviral drug, which reduces mother-to-child transmission of HIV. That case was an important case. It was at a time when the question of HIV and the medical benefits or otherwise of retrovirals was highly politically contested. So it seemed very fraught and tense, and the court firmly came down and said it was not constitutional for the government to limit it when it was clear from the World Health Organization that the administration of nevirapine to a pregnant woman would significantly reduce the likelihood of the child being born with HIV, which of course for most children would have led to their deaths before the age of 5. It seemed a very significant judgment. I think legally it was less complicated than some cases, but it felt very fraught and tense at the time. And of course, the death penalty case was another case which seemed very fraught and tense at the time, and the very first case in which we heard argument, and of course, on which there are still so many, it's still so contested in broader South African society, questions about the constitutionality of the death penalty.
I really understand the unfairness of my question now, because as you share all of that, what also strikes me is that we're testing the edifice of this newly born constitution. We're testing it for its elasticity and its resilience, its ability to rise to and meet the challenges of a South Africa that is finding its identity, finding its feet. And, you know, to have asked you that, I mean, you were in those seminal years where that process was taking place. So I really appreciate you at least trying to distill certain elements. And those were all massive. My next question is slightly complicated and maybe a bit long, but bear with me, because the context bears repeating for people who don't immediately remember the story. This matter relating to the State versus Basson 2005. And for those who don't remember, Dr. Bota Basson, cardiologist, former head of South Africa's chemical and biological warfare program during apartheid. He was alleged to have committed serious human rights violations. And it was a raft of things, poisonings, assassinations, biological warfare that targeted anti-apartheid activists. And the Constitutional Court's involvement in his case primarily centered around some of the procedural issues relating to his criminal trial. It's too much to get into here, and people can go and read that. But the Constitutional Court's decision emphasized the importance of respecting procedural safeguards and judicial independence. That's a term that really comes up a lot these days, even in cases involving alleged gross human rights abuses. It ruled against the state's bid to appeal the ruling by a lower court, still contentious. But how do you frame the responsibilities? I can't use the word limitations the highest court has, but how do you frame its responsibilities and responses when it comes to our unjust and violent history?
Well, I do think that it is a very important part of our constitutional framework that accused persons are entitled to a fair trial. It is core to the idea of the rule of law. It's core to the idea of living safely as a citizen in a state, that the state will not use its power to prosecute and convict you in an unfair way. And although emotionally we can sometimes feel not sympathetic to some accused persons, whether it's Dr. Basson or somebody who's committed allegedly a very brutal murder, we are all protected by the idea that the rule of law is accessible to everybody and that courts will ensure, before somebody is convicted, fairly that the evidence against them has established beyond a reasonable doubt that they have committed this crime. Once you get let go of that idea and you move into a society where people can be convicted and sentenced without having had a fair trial, you destroy that sense of trust that citizens should have that the state will not abuse its power. It does mean at times that people can be acquitted of crimes where one is not certain that they are not guilty, because that is the test that we set. We want people to be established to have committed the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you think of what the consequences are of being convicted of a serious crime, which is imprisonment generally for a long period of time, that is a very serious consequence. And you would not want people to be imprisoned unless you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that they had indeed committed a crime. And I think that we quite often think about this from the perspective of the law-abiding citizen and a sense that there are other people out there who break the law. But sometimes one needs to think about it, as so many people, I think, who lived through the apartheid period did, about having a brother or a child or a parent who is arrested and imprisoned and sometimes sentenced or sometimes just detained without trial by the state, and the great sense of justice that that could give rise to realize that it is something we all want. We don't want to live in a society, I think, where you cannot be satisfied that the state will treat you fairly when you are charged with an offense, and that you can put your case and you can be heard, and that you feel that an independent and impartial judge will listen to you as well as to the prosecution and make a decision fairly.
But how do you manage that responsibility personally when you're dealing with, I mean, you're the highest court in the land. You know, you represent the hopes and aspirations of everybody who comes through those doors as the final arbiter of justice and a resolution for their matters. And you make decisions together with them. That's why you have a bench, so you have that shared sense of responsibility and minds coming together. Just talk to us about the intestinal fortitude you have to have, Kate, in taking on that role, executing it, and being able to, in your life journey, be at peace that the decision you made together with others was the best possible decision that could have been made at any given time.
There's no doubt that you're absolutely right, Iman, to recognize the importance of there being a bench of 11, at least 8 and up to 11 judges to hear these matters, because they are often very weighty and they are often legally difficult. And having the robust debate that one does have with one's colleagues and, of course, with counsel in court is one of the ways of really stress testing the proper way forward and the proper decisions. It is, I think, a burden. It's certainly one of the things I felt when I left the court was this sort of sense of a relief that I don't always have to be waking up every time thinking, is that the right answer? Are we doing it right here? Or of the challenge to try to persuade your colleagues of the right answer, etc. It is quite a relief because many of these cases really impacted on people's lives in very material ways and really shaped the way South African constitutional framework works and our society more broadly. So it is a burden, but it's also a huge privilege. And it's one of the reasons why I'm absolutely convinced that having a diverse bench is really important. People coming from different backgrounds with different experiences at different stages of their lives means that we think about the problems often differently. And that is often illuminating. It makes you see things you might not otherwise have seen, makes you think about things differently. And I think that's really important. It's not always the most comfortable place when somebody comes along and says, but you haven't even thought about this. You know, most of us like to agree with everybody all the time, don't we? It's nice to be in a group of people where we all think the same and we can agree and, you know. But actually, that's not where the best thinking happens. The best thinking happens where you disagree and where you people bring a perspective that you hadn't thought about and that makes you really think. So it's a testament, I think, to the importance of diversity on the bench and an importance of being open-minded to realize that things that you may think are common sense and certain are possibly not common sense at all, but prejudice or short-sightedness or closed-mindedness, and be open to the idea that you need to rethink the way you thought before.
And what you just shared is true not only for the bench, but for broader society. If more people were malleable or were able to suspend their egos, because oftentimes this is ego-driven, the idea of dogma as well, that safety of the confirmation bias and the groups of people that will agree with what we say prevents us from growing and having our points of view mature and evolve. Kate, you now serve as the director of the Bonavera Institute of Human Rights at the University of Oxford, and it is from here that you lead initiatives in human rights law and you focus on issues like equality and social justice. Why do you still keep up the fight for human rights, and give us some examples of the work that you're doing now?
Well, thank you. Yes, it's been such an extraordinary opportunity and so interesting. It's a little bit less known, I imagine, but that Oxford, and it's probably because of the imperial past of the United Kingdom, draws an array of wonderful students from all over the world, many of them interested in human rights. And so the work that the Institute does is we focus on deepening understanding and knowledge of human rights, both within the university and amongst students, but also among students more broadly across the world and more broadly in the general public. And of course, we're a research center, so we engage in cutting edge research in the field of human rights. And in that area, for example, we're doing quite a lot of work on the digital world, on freedom of speech, on AI in employment. We do quite a lot of work on democracy, democratic decay, constitution making, climate change and litigation and how litigation is working in relation to climate change, equality, how law can undo long-standing patterns of inequality. So there are a whole range of things that we work on from a research point of view. In our programming, we run a global moot in the field of media law, which is one of the ways of looking at media and freedom of expression around the world. We hold regional rounds in 6 different regions, the Asia Pacific, which until recently was held in Beijing, but will be held in the Philippines, South Asia in Delhi, the Middle East and North African countries in Cairo, an Africa round in Johannesburg, and a pan-European round. Now, it used to be split between Kiev and Budapest. Because of events recently, it has just moved to Paris and then one in the Americas. So this is really to bring students from universities across the world to debate questions, cutting-edge questions in media law and expression. We also run 2 clinics in prisons in the UK for convicted prisoners who are facing the threat of deportation, which is a big issue in the United Kingdom, as you probably have known from the news. And those are just law clinics which we run with a local law firm representing prisoners who will otherwise face deportation. So we do a whole range of things. And just to give you an example, I jumped onto your call today from a conversation which was about a book that's recently been published by one of our former DPhils here in Oxford, who is from India, on the obligations that come from Bills of Rights and the question of whether powerful organizations, as well as the state, should be bearers of obligations under a Bill of Rights. And the conversation was participated in by a South African lawyer, two Indian lawyers, but also people from much further afield. So it's a way of creating conversations about how the law works. And there is a really growing conversation amongst constitutional democracies in the global South, from, you know, whether it's Mexico, Colombia, Argentina, Chile, India, Sri Lanka, Kenya, South Africa, to have a conversation amongst the global South about constitutional democracy. And we seek to be a venue for those conversations.
I mean, it must be wonderful to be in the center of it all and still, you know, being part of life and activism, Kate.
Well, it is. I mean, the most wonderful thing, I think, and we used to feel this at the court too about the law clerk system, is to see the generations of young people, brilliant young people from all over the world, you know, motivated by kind of a deep sense of commitment to democracy, the rule of law, human rights, wanting to make a contribution in their lives to promoting that from whatever jurisdiction they come. And that sense that we can get depressed and cynical about the world and worried about it because, you know, there's so many terrible things that happen, but constantly being exposed to brilliant young people who really care about these ideas and are so smart and thoughtful, and it's a wonderful place to work.
They're lucky to have you. I've got two quick things to ask you. Maybe one isn't so quick, because I could keep you here for a long time because there's just so much texture to what you're sharing, so many dimensions to the work that you have done and the work that you continue to do. But given your interest and you know, the perspective you have on global politics, South Africa has now filed what's called a memorial to the ICJ. And memorial, for those who don't know, is a document recording the main case that South Africa has against Israel. Back in May, we know in 2024, the ICJ issued preliminary orders. It was the third time this 15-judge panel issued preliminary orders seeking to rein in the death toll and alleviate humanitarian suffering in the blockaded enclave. We know it's a context in which deaths had crossed and exceeded the 44,000 mark. Do you believe that the ICJ has teeth, Kate? And maybe just a commentary as well on international instruments and institutions being able to really stop bloodletting?
Well, I think, you know, it's an excellent question. And I think one of the things to note is that for the International Court of Justice, in many ways, this is quite novel, the idea of being consulted in the middle of what is effectively a severe conflict. And it comes back to some of the questions I was talking about earlier about the limits of law and its ability really to be able to change society, to constrain power. And on the other hand, so, you know, we have continued to see terrible death tolls in Gaza, and it's deeply worrying for all of us. And it is inevitably a sense that although this was really important litigation brought by South Africa and to the International Court of Justice, it hasn't stemmed that terrible death toll and the terrible events that we read about on a daily basis. On the other hand, I do think that even if law can't actually always bring about the results we would like it to do, the very process of documenting and the process of bringing the case is important in terms of recognizing that the Genocide Convention is there for a reason. It is there to stop genocide. Many laws are there for a reason, and to deepen knowledge and understanding of that, and to document the facts of what's happening on the ground. So unfortunately, this is quite often what happens with legal processes. It's unable to produce justice, which is what we want law to be able to do. But it doesn't mean that it is all in vain either.
This is why we say the law is an ass.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think one of the reasons we say the law is an ass is when I think that the law predicts an outcome that all of us thinks is terrible. Here, I suppose what we might say is the law is a weakling.
Okay, so I want to end on this note. You are remembered. I mean, you're still here and long may it be so, but you are remembered as a thoughtful and progressive judge who's advocated for fairness, equality, respect for human dignity. It's borne out by some of your decisions, your judgments, particularly on socioeconomic rights and gender equality. Is leaving a legacy important to you? And if so, what would you hope that would be? And maybe it's a cheeky question because I think you're still writing your story.
Yes, and I am not really, I mean, I feel uncomfortable about thinking about leaving a legacy. I feel very fortunate to have been able to do all sorts of meaningful work, to work with a wonderful array of inspiring people across my life. So I don't really think in legacy terms. I think I was really fortunate and privileged to have those 15 years on the court in its first 15 years. And I think I learned a huge amount there. I don't really think in legacy terms.
Well, that just makes you even more endearing and likable, that you're so humble and still continue with the work. Kay, thank you so much for talking to us today. And I think the standout quote for me in what you shared with us is that the law should live in people's lives. It's so simple, yet so profound. Thank you so much for being available to us today. We appreciate your time and good luck with everything.
Thank you, Iman. And thanks for all the work you've put into thinking about these really interesting questions. And I wish you well with all your work.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Bye now.
You've been listening to Legal Luminaries, a Jackpod original podcast by Duta and Jacaranda FM. I'm Imandra Petty. Find more episodes at jacarandafm.com. Just click on Jackpod.